Appellant versus Blair.
Morning, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, my name is James Wisman. I'm here representing the state of Washington as the appellant in this matter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. This court should hold that the trial court erred in granting a new trial and dismissing charges. The facts were more than sufficient to support the jury's verdict that Blair conspired with others to possess marijuana with intent to deliver. The standard review, as this court is aware, is this court places itself in the same position as the trial court in this matter, which is to assume the facts as presented by the state, to draw all inferences in the light most favorable to the state, and to ask whether there was sufficient evidence from which any reasonable trier of fact could find that a conspiracy for possession with intent to deliver was shown here. Now, the trial court, in our view, erred in two ways. One, by de facto applying a slightly higher standard to what constitutes an agreement. But also, the trial court erred in making several critical mistakes as to what the evidence was. Let me start with the legal side of things first. And as a pretrial ruling at CP 181, it's memorialized in written findings. The trial court found that there was a prima facie case of conspiracy shown. The trial court found that Blair and Dunham were members of that conspiracy. And the trial court found that statements of Blair and Dunham made on the telephone call were in furtherance of the conspiracy. So all of those findings by the trial court were made pretrial. At halftime, the court said there's a prima facie evidence to submit this case to the jury. Specifically a prima facie case of conspiracy. Then the defense presented no case, no witnesses, no evidence, no exhibits, nothing. The jury returned a verdict of guilty, and then the court came out and, in a motion for a new trial or to overturn the jury's verdict, granted the motion to overturn the verdict. Under these circumstances, it's hard to reconcile those rulings with the pretrial rulings and the halftime ruling with the final ruling. It appears, as I say, that the court was demanding a more stringent showing of an agreement than is required under the law. As the court knows, under conspiracy law, we have to show through circumstantial or direct evidence some sort of concert of action where all parties are working understandingly, where there's a single design for a common purpose. No direct negotiation is needed. You can use an intermediary, et cetera. And under these facts, all of those things were shown. The court, rather, seemed to be requiring that the state produce some evidence that Chris Yates and Keith Blair actually had some sort of handshake in the jail. We don't need to produce that sort of evidence. Rather, we need to just show that the concert of action, that the congruence of events allows a reasonable inference to be made that these people were working together. Also, the court misremembered key points or forgot key facts in considering the motion. At RP 297, the court thought that the meeting time was reversed. That wasn't correct. The court did not recall whether or not the 5:30 time was actually set. That was at RP 293. That was said on the tape. The court did not recall that there was only one Chris who was housed in the jail at the same time. That was at RP 297. The court forgot that Yates was, quote-unquote, looking around just before re-entering the jail, which would suggest that he actually had a meeting with somebody and was planning to make that transfer. There's no mention in the court's consideration of the evidence of the fact that the plan, as described on the telephone call, was for Blair to give his wife Dunham, for Blair to give Chris Yates Dunham's telephone number, whereby they'd, of course, be able to communicate by phone after Yates was released on his temporary release. So if you take those, what I characterize as misunderstandings of both the record and the law, I think it explains why the court got off track and granted this motion. If you look just at the facts that were presented, I think they're easily sufficient to show that there was a conspiracy here and to support the jury's verdict. You had the telephone conversation where the defendant was saying, instructing Dunham that he wanted her to come down tomorrow and bring a quart of green, $40 worth, wrap it in a condom, shred it up before doing that. There was talk about this guy named Chris. Dunham recoils at the idea and says, you know, Chris, Keith, it's a setup, clearly indicating that she believes that this is a criminal enterprise that they're in launching on. Dunham is told that Chris is going to get her phone number. Then Chris shows up, you know, in this 10-minute window of time just when they're supposed to meet. Dunham, apparently running late, shows up just outside that window or at 5:59. And then when she's arrested, she has the marijuana wrapped in the condom just as required by their agreement. So I think that all of these facts together lead to the very reasonable inferences drawn by the jury that there was sufficient evidence to convict here. I will note that there is some problem with the transcript. The transcript is kind of thin. We gave the court the tape recording. I hope the court has an opportunity to review that. But I would suggest the court could also rely on Mr. Granis's summary of the transcript. I thought in his brief, I thought it was quite accurate. There are some things that are quite difficult to hear. And in my summary, I didn't go quite as far as he did, but I think that he took a couple leaps of faith. I think he got it right. And so if the court wants to rely on that, it is a fair summary of what was said in that conversation. So for those reasons, we'd ask the court to overturn the trial court's ruling and reinstate the verdict, and I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You'll have a little over 4 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, Casey Granis representing Keith Blair. The trial court got it right. This court should affirm the dismissal of the conspiracy count. In order to prove a conspiracy, the state is entitled to rely on direct evidence of the conspiracy, circumstantial evidence, and it's entitled to draw, and the jury is entitled to draw reasonable inferences from that evidence. But what the state is not entitled to do, and what no trier of fact is entitled to do, is rely on conjecture, speculation, or guesswork to prove an element. This case illustrates the distinction between those two. Now, if I'm only able to make one point today, it's the point that blows the state's case out of the water. And it focuses in on one of the elements of the conspiracy that the state needed to prove, and that is the subject crime at issue here. It's not enough for the state to show, or for the evidence to establish, any old agreement between Blair and Yates. It's not enough for the evidence to show that there was an agreement between Blair and Yates to do any violation of the Uniform Controlled Substances Act. The state needed to prove that Yates and Blair agreed to commit the specific crime at issue here, the crime that was charged as the underlying crime. And consistent with the jury's instructions, the state needed to prove that Blair and Yates agreed to commit the specific crime of possession with intent to deliver. And that's important here because there's no evidence to show that from Blair's perspective or from Yates' perspective that either one of them agreed that Blair, no evidence to show that Yates, once there was agreement to receive the marijuana, no evidence to show what he intended to do with it after he got it. Now, if the state had charged conspiracy and the underlying, with the subject crime being conspiracy to commit possession of marijuana, the state would have a much stronger argument here, I would say. I want to concede that it still win the day, but it had a much stronger argument. But here, we have something more that needs to be shown. Not just that they agreed that Yates would wind up in possession of this marijuana. They needed to show what Yates intended to do with it via the agreement. They need to show that Blair agreed that Yates, once he got this marijuana, intended to deliver it to others. And they needed, conversely, they needed to show that Yates agreed to the same thing. And we don't have that here. It's a black hole. It's a black hole in this case. And it's the black hole that sucks the state's argument down into oblivion, quite frankly. We don't need to go any further than that particular point to show why there's not enough evidence to convict Blair here. And in regards to that, I'll point out that Dunham, when she's busted, she's got 2.5 grams of marijuana on her. 2.5 grams of marijuana. Not 25, not 250, not something that would show intent to, that there was an intent to distribute to others as opposed to, say, personal use, which is at most all the state proved here. Which is that perhaps there's a conspiracy, the Gates get a hold of this marijuana. 2.5 grams worth. The evidence doesn't show what Gates, that both Blair and Gates, and it takes two to tango, the evidence doesn't show that both of them agreed what Gates would do with that marijuana once he got it. And that's the dispositive issue here. I mean, we could look at this case from different angles, and the briefing from both sides looks at it from different angles. But this particular angle that I'm focusing in on here today is the one that should carry the day. And also, another point in relation to this is that...
Is our task today any different than if Judge Craighead had denied the motion and we were being asked to conduct a sufficiency of the evidence analysis on the conviction?
No. This is a question of law. I mean, review de novo. There's no dispute about that. Makes no difference whether it was denied or affirmed. The sufficiency of evidence issue is reviewed the same way. And one further point I wish to make on this is that the state needed to prove not merely, in order to prove the conspiracy here of possession with intent to deliver, to commit that crime, the state needed to do more than prove that Blair could foresee that Yates might be going ahead and delivering that marijuana to others. But that's Pinkerton liability. That's not the law in Washington on conspiracy. In Washington, the state needed to prove that Blair knew, as part of this agreement, that Yates would, that Yates intended to deliver that marijuana to others, either in the jail or somewhere else. Evidence doesn't show that.
Can it be delivered amongst the conspirators, or does it have to be delivered outside of the conspiracy?
The way this case was tried, and on the facts of this case, the state needed to show that the marijuana at issue was intended to be delivered to someone outside of that conspiracy ring. And for that, I could quote from the state's brief. The state's brief at page 15, the state's brief at page 17, the opening brief. The state argues the evidence clearly showed that Blair and Dunham conspired to have Dunham give marijuana to Yates, so far so good, so that Yates could later deliver the substance to others. And that's entirely consistent with the way the state's theory was presented to the jury. We have at page 249 of the state's closing argument on September 14, 2011. Addressing this particular element of possession with intent to deliver, what does it mean for this case? The prosecutor tells the jury, that means that Christopher Yates would get that package of marijuana to bring that in and distribute it later. It's not going to Dunham, in other words. It's not going back to Blair. It's going to someone else. But the evidence doesn't get us there. And for those reasons, this court should affirm the trial court that the conspiracy count should be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you. Just want to make a couple brief points. First, in answer both to Judge Dwyer's comment or question and also to counsel's argument, the conspiracy can exist amongst just the conspirators. Let me state that differently. The delivery can occur just amongst the conspirators. And, in fact, Dunham, the wife, was charged with possession with intent to deliver. And so the crime itself was completed when or if she had delivered the marijuana to Yates. Now, in fact, I think it's true that the marijuana was intended to come into the jail and end up in somebody else's hands. In the certification, for example, there's some talk about Joshua Hellman, who was another person in the jail who was involved in this. That was never placed before the jury for a number of other pretrial legal issues that came up. But in any event, so counsel's main argument fails. I mean, you satisfy the conspiracy if you make the delivery. The conspiracy was that there should, at a minimum, be a delivery that occurred between Dunham and Yates. But ultimately, I think it extended further. I think the marijuana was destined for others.
What did the jury instruction require the jury to find, if you recall?
Well, the jury instruction required to find that there was a conspiracy to commit intent to deliver, and possession with intent to deliver, it did not specify people. And so I think as in all kind of possession with intent to deliver cases, we don't specify an individual who was the ultimate recipient, just that you had the possession, you had the intent, and that's satisfied here, and as I'm saying, in any number of ways. So if the court remembers, there's also some discussion at the end of the telephone call about perhaps Christopher Yates going to either Bellingham or Billings, Montana, or something like that. And it's unclear whether Blair was saying that in order to coax Dunham to actually pass these drugs on to Yates, because I think Blair was rightfully concerned that Dunham didn't want to do this, that she was very reluctant to do it. In the end, our theory doesn't depend on where it was going to end up, either in the jail, with some individual in the jail, or, you know, in Bellingham or Billings. The point is that this conspiracy was put together whereby drugs were going to be transferred from Dunham to Yates and probably further. But we don't have to show further where. I also wanted to emphasize a couple of other facts that I think bolster the jury's verdict. As counsel said in his brief or in the summary, the agreement here was to bring a quart of shredded green in a condom. Now, if you have an agreement to bring something in a condom, if there really is an agreement, and the court found that there was one between Dunham and Blair, somebody could not inadvertently enter into such an agreement.
It was a conspiracy to have Dunham possess the drugs, or a conspiracy to have Yates possess the drugs?
Both. I mean, the conspiracy was to put into motion this series of events that would lead to the drugs ending up in Yates's possession. For legal purposes, it doesn't matter whether Yates was going to go someplace else or bring it back into the jail. In fact, our belief and our theory was that he was going to bring it back into the jail. But for legal purposes, that doesn't matter. As long as you have the transfer from Dunham to Yates, or the intended transfer from Dunham to Yates, you've satisfied the legal requirements of the law. And my point is that somebody in Yates's position wouldn't be cooperating with this whole sequence of events, and his cooperation is suggested by the sequence of events, unless you knew exactly what you were doing. Because if you have drugs in a condom, there's only one thing you're going to do with that. Perhaps you stick it in your mouth to try and get it past the jail guards. Perhaps you're sticking it in your rectum to get it past the jail guards. But you're not just going to walk in the door and hand it over to somebody within the jail. Thank you. We ask the court to reverse.
Thank you.